Welcome to the Disney Parks Podcast with your hosts, Tony Castelnova from DisneyByTheNumbers.com and Krista Joy from DisneyWays.com. Keep your hands, arms, feet, and legs inside the podcast at all times and get ready for the Disney Parks Podcast.
Everyone, and welcome to the show. We are super excited today to have Jeff Sherman on the line for you. How are you, Jeff?
I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
Doing great. We're so excited to have you on the show tonight. Thanks for your time. I think Tony's going to go ahead and kick it off with the first question.
Great.
Okay, fantastic.
Yep. Hey, Jeff, can you tell us about the time that you met Walt Disney?
Well, I met Walt, I should say Mr. Disney, because that's how I knew him. But I met him on a number of occasions. What they do at Disney Studios is at Christmas time, Walt liked to have parties for all the employees' kids. And so in the on the Buena Vista parking lot, they would close off the parking lot. And they would have all these booths set up with games, and you could get presents like little pinball machines and things like that. And all the characters would come out, but Walt would always come out as well. And then we'd get to see some cartoons or something in the little theater there. So I would meet him sort of casually on those occasions. But there was one time I met Walt that was a little more special. And it was when they were making Mary Poppins. My father had told my sister Lori and myself the story. He'd read the stories to us, the Mary Poppins stories, and then he told us all the magical things that were happening in the studio with all the things they were creating, and that there was going to be a staircase made out of smoke and all these things. I heard all this magical stuff. So my dad one day surprised me, and he said, I'm going to take you down to Disney Studios with me today. And I was a little kid. I was probably, 5 years old, and 5 or 6. And so he took me out of school, and we went over to Disney Studios, and he took me over to the sound stages. At the time, all the sound stages were dedicated to Mary Poppins. So, in other words, stage 2, the big stage on the lot there, was Cherry Tree Lane. So it was all dressed up like Cherry Tree Lane. And these all, it was kind of interesting to me, but there were workmen hammering and, guys with tool belts on and dust, and you could see everything around it. It looked kind of phony to me. I didn't really understand it. And they took me to see the rooftops of London, and my dad took me over to the merry-go-round, which was up against a screen so that it would be kind of a special effects screen. And everything to me was fine. My dad took me back over to the commissary, and Walt walked in, and Mr. Disney. And Mr. Disney walked in with a couple of bankers, it looked like to me. And he had a knack of knowing not only all his employees' names, but sometimes their kids' names, too. And I'd met him on a couple of occasions. So he leaned down and he said, "So, Jeff, I understand you took a look at our sets today for Mary Poppins." And I said, "Yeah." I'm holding my dad's hand. And he said, "What'd you think?" And I said, "They're okay, I guess." And my dad's hand went limp. I don't know if anybody out there has had that experience. When you said something, you're holding your parent's hand, and it completely embarrasses them. And I looked up at him like I knew something was wrong. And I saw this, concerned look on Walt's face. And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "I don't know." He goes, "You come with me." And I thought I was in trouble, and I looked back at my dad, and he's just shaking his head. And Walt walked me back over to one of the sound stages that was near the commissary, and he turned on the work lights, and it was the room where the rooftops of London, where they did Step in Time, was. And so he took me over there, and he walks me over to it, and he says, "So what's wrong with this?" I said, "Well, I just don't think anybody's going to believe it." He said, "What do you mean they're not going to believe it? I've had the greatest artist in the world study the real architecture, the real thing." He's giving me this whole speech about selling it to me. I said, "Well, but it's right here on the ground." And he looked at me like I was the dumbest kid in the universe. Nicely. And he started laughing, and he knelt down next to me and put his hands together like he would show like a picture frame. Or a camera frame, and he said, "This is what the camera's going to see. They're not going to know that this is on the ground. They're going to, and they'll believe it." And he said, "That's called movie magic, and you can never tell your friends how it's done." And I just did. sorry, Mr. Disney. But it was, you know, sort of an eye-opening thing for me, and it really started me, sparked me wanting to do that myself, to make that kind of magic, which I've gone on to do.
Yeah.
That's a great story.
So sweet. Yeah, you've had a wonderful career in your own right. Now, you actually, we understand that your dad did a really sweet personal dedication of the River Song to you at the recording session with Charlie Pride. Will you tell us about that? I love that story, too.
Sure. But they were making a Tom Sawyer, at the production of it was in Missouri or in Natchez, Mississippi or something, I think. But they were doing all the post-production stuff and some of the recording and all that at 20th Century Fox Studios. And at the time, I was a junior or a senior in at Beverly Hills High School, which sort of backs right up to where 20th Century Fox was or is. And so Arthur Jacobs, who was the producer of the movie Tom Sawyer, found out that I was interested in making film and I was interested in music and everything. And he said, look, anytime you want to come to dailies or you want to come to recording sessions, please just ride over. I'm going to put your name at the gate. You can wave and ride your bike right onto the gate, which nobody does. And I was able to do that. It was really sweet. So I would go over there every day after school, but one day Dad said, can you come at lunchtime? And I said, sure. So I rode over and rode my bike over, and it was the session where they were doing the song River Song, which was the title song for the movie. And I'd heard the demos and everything. Now, you have to understand, this is a pretty cool session because it's about 120 musicians, and it's John Williams is the arranger-conductor. It's the last of the pieces that he did that he didn't write himself. And he was adapting the Sherman Brothers score. So I got to sit with him a lot and watch this, and just wonderful to sit in those sessions. Well, but this session was special, and Arthur Jacobs walked in, and he had a box. And he opened up the box. He said, I just got these. These are hot off the press. He's this great little guy. He was wonderful, Arthur. And he picks up, and it's T-shirts for Tom Sawyer. He said, Jeff, you get the first one. And he holds it up to me, and I looked at him, and he said, put it on. I want to see how it looks. So I put it on. And my dad said, come with me. I want to show you something. And so they had just recorded the musical part of the main theme for the movie, which sort of butts into the River Song. And I, of course, heard the song and everything, but I didn't really know much about it. And it's a story, it's the sort of the theme song of a boy by the riverside who's growing up and getting older and moving on. So I hear it, and then this kind of funny-looking guy walks in, and it's Charlie Pride, this wonderful, and he was hot as could be, this country singer. He's really nice. I met him, and so he sings the song, and it's this beautiful song, and he's singing it to the playback of the movie. They have a cut, and it's playing on the screen above us. And so my dad's puts his arm around me, and when the song was over, he turned to me, and he said, I wrote that song for you.
Yeah. And all the women that are listening right now go,
it's a beautiful, beautiful song, beautiful story. But I was right there, and Charlie sang it right live, right in front of me, and it was that moment. So, and the wonderful thing was, right afterward, we took a picture. I think I sent it to you, and the three of us are standing there together. So, it's pretty special to me.
Yeah, wow. Awesome. We'll definitely be putting that in the show notes. If it's okay with you, we'll share with everybody.
So, Jeff, we know that you created, wrote, produced, and worked on different things with your dad and your uncle. And one of them was the first Disney Channel shows that was called The Enchanted Musical Playhouse. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it was a dream of mine to... My dad used to read me stories of my mom, but there was one story in particular that my dad would read me a lot when I was a kid called The Steadfast Tin Soldier. It's a Hans Christian Andersen story. And when I was about 14, I started just writing some songs. You know, I'd been around it. My grandfather was also a composer, and he'd given me piano lessons. And so I learned to do that. But, coming from a family of composers, you you tend to want to try it yourself. And so I tried adapting the Tin Soldier, and I put in a couple of the songs when I was 14. And then when I got out of UCLA Film School, it was in the I was out of there in 79 and did a couple of movies afterward, but I had this urge to do a series. And I went with my dad to the opening celebration of the Disney Channel. It was at the back when there used to be a back lot at Disney Studios, the old town square and all that. And they threw this big party. And I started getting this thought that what if we did, and I started talking to my dad right there at the table. I said, what if we did for Disney Channel a series of like half hour musicals based on children's classics? And he said, oh, I'd love to do that. And my uncle was there too. So I leaned over to him and said, this is what I've got. And he goes, great, great, we should do it. So I just walked over, I forgot what his name was, but I walked over to the head of the thing at this celebration. I said, I want to come in and pitch a show that I want to do with the Sherman Brothers. He goes, come in next week. And so I came in, and they had just set up shop. They were just brand new. And I went in, and my dad and uncle didn't come with me, but I went in, and I said, I want to do these shows. And they said, that sounds perfect for us. That sounds great. What stories were you thinking of doing? I told them The Velveteen Rabbit and some of the other classics I wanted to. They said, that sounds great. They said, but the Sherman Brothers, can we afford them? And I said, oh, yeah. He goes, well, what are they going to ask for a song? And I said, I had no idea what they made. My dad and I never talked about that. So I said, you know, probably like about $5,000 a song. He said, great, sign here. All right. So I go back and I tell my dad they want to do this show. And he said, you said, how much? And, you know, apparently that was well under their scale, but they decided they would do that for me. And in the process, I teamed up with a company called Centerpoint, and they put me together with Jimmy Osmond of the Osmond Family. And the Osmond Show had been off the air, and they had the studio out in Provo, Utah, and they were looking for things to do with it. So I met with Jimmy, and we really hit it off. And then Donnie Osmond also came in, and they partnered up with me, and the three of us produced this one of the first series for the Disney Channel. And it's called The Enchanted Musical Playhouse, as you said. And we did four episodes, four half-hour musicals. We did The Velveteen Rabbit, that I wrote and produced, and my dad and uncle wrote the songs. And we did the same sort of setup with a story called Petronella, which is about an empowered princess, which was a wonderful piece. And then my dad and uncle wrote the songs and the script for the story of Ferdinand the Bull with Paul Williams. And I finished the score for The Steadfast Tin Soldier. So I wrote the score and the script, the songs for The Steadfast Tin Soldier. But the first episode we had, Marie Osmond agreed to play the Velveteen Rabbit. So it was wonderful for me because I'm in Provo, Utah, and I'm working with like the core Osmonds that everybody knows. And Jay Osmond worked on it as well. And the other brothers, Alan and the other guys, they would come in, and it was just a wonderful, fun experience. Just really great. We shot these things in a couple of days each. And then we'd go and we'd have dinner, and I'd be sitting with the Osmonds, and I think it's like going out with Prince Charles in England, you know, when you're in Utah with the Osmonds, every place closes down. So we just had a blast, and I got a lot of time with Jimmy and Donnie, and just really got to love those guys. They're terrific guys, very talented.
Do you guys all stay in touch?
I still talk to Jimmy occasionally. I haven't spoken to Donnie in a while. He's hard to pin down. I probably could. I just haven't. He's sort of lost touch. But the fun thing was for me is that I got to collaborate with my father and uncle in the room with them, and I learned how they went about approaching songs on a firsthand basis. Because I was writing the scripts, and I had to figure out how to incorporate their songs, and do the songs come first or the story comes. So they taught me their process, and I've used that, and now I'm implementing that in a bunch of things. I'm doing a bunch of musical projects now. So it was a wonderful experience, and just working with the Osmonds and learning recording and dancing and professionalism. I mean, it was just a wonderful, wonderful training ground for me.
That's awesome. And you were a big fan of Donnie Osmond, and I guess he gave you a recording of one of the songs.
yeah, the first song I'd ever written for the Steadfast Tin Soldier, the reason I love that story so much is my dad would read it to me, but it's about a one-legged tin soldier, if you know the story. And my father, if you know, if you saw The Boys, the documentary that Greg, my cousin Greg and I did, my dad had been shot in the leg and had a very sore, sort of, you know, stiff leg all his life. So I kind of related him to the tin soldier. And I wrote a song called Stand Tall. And it's about standing tall against adversity. And if you stand tall, that the battle is almost won. So I recorded this thing, you know, I did the demo of it. And I have a horrible voice. I unfortunately inherited my father's voice. He would tell you himself. It was just not great. And anyway, but so, I hired the mime team of Shields and Yarnell to play the core characters in this piece. And Robert Shields sang the demo. And, you know, he was more of a mime than a singer as well, but he did a really good job with it. But and afterward, he walked out, and Donnie was sitting in the booth with me, and he said, and he knew what a big fan of his I was, and he said, hey, can we just do an extra track? I'm going to go in there and try this out. I want to try it. I want to sing this song. And I was like, I was stunned. I never would have asked him in a million years, but I was a big Donnie Osmond fan. I grew up, you know, he and I are about the same age, and I grew up with him and was a big fan. So he went in and sang my song, and I still have that. I treasure that recording now.
Wow, that's great.
It's so sweet. You got to hear it, Tony. I don't know if I sent it to Tony, but it's great.
Yeah,
it's beautiful. Beautiful.
Can you tell us the time, Jeff, that you broke into tears while appearing on a live remote with your dad and uncle on TV?
Yes.
How old were you? Let's start with that.
Yeah.
I should joke and say 27, but I think I was, just around the Poppins time, so I was probably 6 or 7 again, right around then. And as being a Disney kid growing up in that era, I was on album covers, and I was the shyest kid. I'm that kid that would like grab the father's leg and hide behind it. That was me, and have an asthma attack and collapse. So I don't know why they asked me, but they took me out of school, and they were doing some live remote on some show. It might have been Mickey Mouse Club. I don't really know because I was so young, but it was live. I remember this. And so they set up a piano and cameras, and they had me sitting with my dad and uncle and expected I was going to sing along with the songs. And I sat there quietly, and they were going, and they kept kind of like, you know, saying, please, you know, start singing, you know, whatever. And I just wouldn't. And so then they stopped at the end of the song, and the interviewer said, so Jeffrey, tell me what your favorite Sherman Brothers song is. And I looked at it, and I burst into tears on live TV. And my dad I just saw him like rubbing his brow. What have I done here? This is horrible. I should have known. And so when they came back from the commercial break, I was no longer sitting there. That was the end of my live appearances with the Sherman Brothers.
Oh my goodness.
Now I'm guessing this was when you were younger too, but there's a story about when you had like an asthma attack when you were recording. And then that funicello
like
kind of
comforted you. Kid, don't I?
Yeah,
Mr. High Maintenance. That was the tough kid. Yeah, but again, we would get pulled into things. They did, you know, Disney had his Disney records, Walt Disney Records, Disneyland Records, I think it was, label. And so they would get called, you know, they would call in, does anybody have kids that will be on an album cover, or will they sing on these things? And I to this day, I still don't know why. My parents knew me pretty well, and I don't know why they asked me, but so I'm on the cover of something called Stories of Aesop. All I remember was it was a very scratchy burlap bag, and I had to stare uncomfortably at Sterling Holloway for about 2 hours in the hot light. That's what I remember from the experience, but that's hanging on my wall right behind me here. My first gig at Disney. But I was doing singing with a kids group for a thing called Acting Out the ABCs, and probably some of the Disney fans out there have that old LP. So I was one of the kids that they had do it. My older sister, Lori, who's a complete extrovert and a terrific like professional singer, loved the experience. And she was having a great time. And they had us going around singing like all around the mulberry bush, right? So we were doing these kind of songs that I didn't know all of them. And I was getting shy. And some of the kids were pushing me. And I'm not sure if I had one or if I faked an asthma attack, but I wanted to get out of there. And so I fell down in the middle of the recording. Kids were tripping over me, and they kind of pulled me over to the side as I was taken away. And it happened, Annette Funicello, who was a very close family friend, my dad and uncle, they were sort of intertwined in their Disney connection. She was a big Mouseketeer, and that's how they got in there. Anyway, she was a friendly, and she knew that the kids were coming down. I used to hang out with her. And she was a little bit older than I was, and she was a professional. She'd been on the Mickey Mouse Club, so I was very upset. And so she took me aside, and I was like really embarrassed. And she said, look, I used to always get upset when I was a little kid on these things. You get over it and don't even worry. Nobody even cares. And she just put her arm around me. And then that Funicello was like comforting me. Aww. Just a sweet, sweet woman.
Yeah. It's funny, Jeff. My father is like a great, great, great cousin of Annette Funicello. I'm not sure the relationship, but you know, somehow they're like very, very, you know, distant cousins. But
go ahead.
Yeah. So somewhere in my family tree, there's a Annette Funicello is related to me.
That's a good tree to be from, I'll tell you. Yeah. We hung out a lot there, and I remember my first crush ever was on Annette Funicello, and then one day she had her friend Shelley Fabre walk in, and I went, okay, I like her too. New crush. So, but
she seems beautiful too.
Yeah, she did the TV show with Coach, right?
Yeah, she did an Elvis movie, and she was on the I knew her from the Donna Reed show.
Right.
The funny thing was, I was trick-or-treating in my neighborhood here in Studio City, and one day I ring the doorbell and Shelley Fabre opens the door. I said, okay, I gotta tell you a story. And I told her that story about when she was hanging out with Annette. She thought that was, I don't think that'd be that funny, and I remember, she told my son, she had this big bowl of candy, and she said, go ahead and take as much as you want. She was just talking to me. And I go over, and I look over at her shoulder, and I see my son is just dumping handfuls of candy into his bag. And no, don't mess it up for me with the Shelley Fabre. Anyway, everything's fine now.
You probably have to go back and go, all right, we're sorry, here's another bag of candy.
we got out of there fast. That's all I can say.
Yeah. So you worked with your dad and uncle in their office on many, many projects. You worked your way up to like assistant stage manager at a local musical of Victory Canteen. Did you have any favorite projects that you worked on with your dad and uncle?
Yeah, I think the one that I worked on that most intensively with them is I wrote a screenplay on spec called Vine Street. And Vine Street was loosely based on my dad and uncle's early career as songwriters on Vine Street, when Vine Street was sort of the center of the music business. It had gone from Tin Tan Alley in New York City. And when TV and movies came out here, Vine Street became kind of the core center of the music business. So I actually, when I got out of film school, I decided I needed to have an office, and I just happened to get an office on right near, everybody knows the intersection of Sunset and Vine, or Hollywood and Vine. It's a street right in between there. It's called Selma, and I found this little office for $75 a month, and I decided I'd take it, and I wanted my dad to take a look at it. And he came over and he said to me, he looked at the building, kind of put his hands on his hips, and he looked up, he goes, how did you choose this building? I said, I just felt like where I should be working. And he said, let me tell you about Vine Street. And he told me this beautiful, lovely story about just going door to door at the music publishers' offices and running around and hearing that somebody needed a song and writing it that afternoon. And I was so thrilled with this. So anyway, I wrote the screenplay, and I talked to them endlessly about it. And they put me in touch with publishers and performers. And I spoke to tons of people about that era with their help. And then they came back and they were going to write the songs with me. And I ended up optioning that script for a lot of money to a company called Interscope. Madonna was going to be the woman in the story. So she was attached to the project for a while. And then nobody wanted to make a Madonna movie, and the movie kind of died. But it was such a wonderful experience because what it was, that experience, I really got to know them in their kind of hungry years. And then when Greg and I did The Boys, of course, that was the most fulfilling thing, doing the documentary about them, The Boys, the Sherman Brothers story. We really got an incredible insight into not only our dads, but also our grandparents and just the whole culture of the music and the Disney experience and got to meet all the colleagues from Disney. And it was such a beautiful, fulfilling experience for us and also for our dads. They really, you know, appreciated having their story told. So that was a wonderful experience as well.
That was like a 3-year process, right?
3.5, beginning to end. I thought it would take 9 months. I come from mostly TV background. I worked on, you know, Boy Meets World and a bunch of different series, and everything kind of moves fast. And I had no idea. I'd never done a documentary, and I figured, how complex could this story be? Well, about 90 interviews later, all over the world, with everybody from Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke to John Williams and Kenny Loggins and Roy Disney and you name it, Barbara Broccoli, who produces all the James Bond films, and her dad did Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and knew them as a little girl, and you know, just going around and talking to all these people, John Davidson and Leslie Ann Warren, it just goes on and on, John Lasseter, Randy Newman, just to get a whole sense of who they were was amazing, but it took forever. And after we shot it, what I didn't realize is it takes forever to construct a documentary. Even if you know what you're doing, the movie changes as you're shooting that material. And you go down new roads and learn new things, and you say, oh, this is what it's about. Oh, that's what it's about. And so ultimately, it took us 2.5 years to make it and about another year to do all the legal stuff, clearing. We had over 160 songs in the movie, which I think is a record for any movie.
Wow.
And the thing is, it's very hard to clear those songs. You have to make individual deals on every one of those. So a lot of them were Disney songs, but a lot of them weren't. And some of the songs were, everything in it was written either by our dad and uncle or our grandfather. But our grandfather's copyrights go back to like the 1920s. And you have to trace who has the rights to these things. And each movie has different stories. You know, if it's a Paramount movie, but some other production company can't, you had to find out where the bottom line was. So that took us about a year to get all that and the final editing done. But the most wonderful thing about it was after the movie came out, it reminded people about who our dads were. And for the first time, even for myself, I grew up in it, but to really see all of it laid out and see this body of work, it's really breathtaking how much they did and the quality that they always maintained in all those years, doing things for everything from Disneyland to the TV shows and movies and stage plays and commercials. And we found old McDonald's commercials they'd done. Do you know,
wow.
I found this wonderful thing. People don't know about this, and we didn't know how to tell the story, but it's wonderful. My dad told me when I was doing this, there's a box of stuff I've got, odds and ends, but there's some really interesting things in there. So I found the Academy Award footage. I found, you know, different things, but there was this one little white box, and there was some scribbling on the side of it, and I put it in a thing, and it was a 16mm film of a McDonald's commercial that they wrote the songs for. But the interesting thing was, on the box were my dad's scribblings. And he had three things. He'd written three things. He said, people shouldn't eat on commercials. I don't remember what the second one was, but the third one was, it said MC, and in quotes. And so I said, what's that? He said, oh, we were called down to the advertising company, and they just made these little chicken nuggets. And it occurred to me, my dad said, that they should call it McNuggets.
Oh, come on.
So my dad branded McShakes, McNuggets, he said, you should do that with all of it. And they said, everything you say in this room, because they were under contract, everything you say in this room is property of the McDonald's Corporation, and we own that. So whenever you have a mix something at McDonald's, Bob Sherman came up with that.
That's on that little box. That's incredible.
It's just amazing. You know, just little things that any one of us would love. One of those little things,
Oh, fell out of them. So it would be great, Jeff, if there was a Sherman website with all this great history and a music catalog going back to your grandparents and your grandfather and his music. That would be a fascinating website.
You know, in your downtime.
In your downtime, in between things.
My brother Robbie's sort of taken up the mantle of keeping that stuff alive. And I know that there's on Facebook, there's a Sherman Brothers page or two that he's done. I don't really get involved in that with him, but that's sort of his thing. But yeah, I've always thought it would be a wonderful thing. You know, that people look at The Godfather and those kind of movies and stuff. What a wonderful story about Russian immigrant. My grandfather had to escape from Russia because the Cossacks were coming and they escaped to Hungary. To Czechoslovakia, and then they came to New York City, and were there in the at the turn of the century. And he worked his way up to becoming one of the biggest Tin Pan Alley songwriters, and wrote about positive things, and then influenced the Sherman Brothers. The other thing about my grandfather was he was very good friends with this guy named George Gerson, and George was this guy. They both were working at this place called Remick Music, and they were in the old days. They used to sell sheet music by performing them, in these little rooms for people, and they'd buy the sheet music and go home and play them in their parlors. Well, George started writing songs and changed his name to George Gershwin. And he kept trying to get my grandfather. He said, you should write songs. There's so much more money in it. So my grandfather started writing because of him. And my grandfather, Al Sherman, returned the favor one day because George was looking for a lyricist. And he was friends with the family. And he knew that Ira Gershwin, wanted to be a songwriter and was too afraid to ask his brother because his brother was a big celebrity at that point. And he set up the meeting and put the Gershwin brothers together and then eventually put the Sherman brothers together. So, I always thought it'd be really interesting to do, a series of sort of our family business of what happened with those two generations. I agree with you that it's pretty interesting.
Because, we hear as, fans of the Sherman universe, some of these stories and things like that you're telling, we've heard from Greg and Robbie and, even some of the things that are on Facebook that get posted. And they're great. We all love them.
Mm-hmm.
It would just, be great to have more of them, but, it's tough.
I'll eventually write a book. I've been collecting some stories and things, that's forthcoming. It'll be there.
Oh, wonderful. Now let's go back to the Au Pair movies. Am I saying that correctly? Au Pair?
Yeah. Au Pair.
Au Pair. See, I knew I wasn't saying it right. I'm not familiar with those personally, so maybe you could tell there's probably a couple other people that don't know about them. I know they were very highly rated programs on Fox Family. They did really well. Yeah. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was. I'd written a screenplay and called Au Pair, and it was sort of based on experience I'd had. I was a nanny, as they call them now, but I was a male nanny when I was in college to pay for my student films. I would babysit kids live in the houses and do that on the summers. And it gave me the idea to, I said, okay, I don't want to do it about a guy, but I'll do it about a woman that comes in and accidentally gets hired as a nanny to this very wealthy man in a business that she'd really like to be in a big corporation and traveling through Europe and all this. So I wrote the script to be a feature. I couldn't sell it. It did get me onto Boy Meets World. That was the piece that they read and asked me to be on that show. But I couldn't get it made. And then one day I get a phone call from this woman. She said, is Au Pair available? And I said, yeah, I have 12 of them in a box. How many would you like? I thought it was some friend of mine like messing with me. And she said, no, this is Cheryl Saban. My husband owns Fox Family Channel, and we'd like to make the movie. And I said, okay. And I went and met with her, and she and the other head of the company, president of the company, a guy named Lance Robbins, fell in love with it. It became a high priority movie for the Fox Family Channel. And in fact, Cheryl's daughter, Heidi Saban, starred in it with Gregory Harrison. And it came on the air, and it was... it remains the highest rated movie ever on Fox Family, and I believe on ABC Family. It was a huge, at the time the channel had been on the air for 22 years, it was the highest rated program. Wow. And so the funny part of that was, you know, I'd written this as a feature, and I really hadn't thought about it beyond just this one story. And Cheryl, I heard that Chaim Saban, the head of the company, wanted me to come down to the office in Westwood and meet him because I hadn't met him. So I went down to the office, and I see Cheryl in the lobby, and the office has huge letters on top, Saban, right? So it's their building. And I'm going up to the pen. I said, so Cheryl, what's the point of this meeting? She goes, oh, Chaim wants you to pitch part two. I went, now? So I came up with Au Pair 2 in the elevator ride from the lobby to the penthouse and sold it there in 5 minutes. It's the easiest job I ever, you know, quickest thing I ever sold.
Wow.
But and then the second one was the second highest rated thing ever on the channel. So it was a big hit. And then I thought, that's fantastic. And it was nice for me because I've done about 3/4 of my work for Disney Studios. So it was kind of good to diversify a little bit and be elsewhere. It was Fox at the time. Anyway, so you probably know that Fox Family was bought by ABC Family. Became ABC Family. It was bought by Disney Studios. And they looked back and they saw that these were these two big hit movies for them, and there wasn't a third one done. So about 10 years after the first one, they had me do another one. So there's three of them. There are as many Au Pair movies as there are Godfather films. That's what my claim to fame. So, but I'm very proud of them. They're really successful, and they've got it's funny because I have the posters on my wall, and people come in, and every now and then you see somebody who just goes, "Wow, you did those!" You know, it's kind of fun.
Yeah, I think it must be the only person that hasn't seen those yet. But that's great. I need to check them out. Now you included a little nod to Mary Poppins in one of the movies, right?
Yeah, on the first one, because, you know, of course, there's going to be a comparison drawn. It's about a nanny, so there you go. And so I figured I'm just going to put it, you know, right, I'm going to just say it right there. So there's a moment, it's these two little kids who are rich kids in the movie, and they hate when the nannies come in. They try to get them fired or get them to quit because when their dad's so busy with work, if they have a nanny, he doesn't pay any attention to them. So they just are merciless to her the first night she gets there. And so the next morning, I decided I'd have one of the kids go, and I think Mary Poppins is tweaked, like she's tired, and she bumps her head. That was my little tip of the hat to Mary Poppins, because you know, it wasn't exactly Jane and Michael Banks. They were pretty rambunctious kids too, though, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. If you listen to the song about all the things they did to all their nannies.
Yeah, I always thought that was supposed to be me and my sister, Lori. It kind of felt like us a little bit.
Really?
We pranked on our nannies. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I'm sure.
Now, I hear that you had another run-in with, you know, you talked about Donnie Marie. Now, you had a run-in with the Monkees while you were shooting an episode of Boy Meets World.
Yeah, I was a writer producer on Boy Meets World, and we were looking for sweeps episodes. Sweeps are the episodes when you try to get they do the ratings, and you know it's usually like somebody dies or some big guest star comes in or something on the show. So I was friends with Mickey Dolenz, who was the drummer in the Monkees and really the lead singer, sang all their big hits except for
Daydream Believer.
He did most of the big songs. You know, he did the Monkees theme and the Last Train to Clarksville and all of it. Anyway, but he and I were friends. And the Monkees hadn't really been together. They were, you know, sort of the, you know, the having those band problems that they often have. And they hadn't been together in about 8 or 9 years at this point. And, you know, I'd met Peter Tork at parties, and I'd met, you know, different, I met
Mike.
I hadn't met Mike. I met Davey a couple times, and just in Pat, you know, because you know they were friendly, but as a band, they weren't really playing together. So I was at dinner with Mickey, and I said, "Is there any way that we could get the Monkees together to be on Boy Meets World?" He goes, "No." I said, what do you mean? He goes, we haven't been together, Jeff, in 8 or 9 years. You're not going to get us together. It's just not going to happen. And even if you couldn't afford it for your show. And I said, well, can I try? Because you can try. And he said, you know, you can try anything. So I got on the phone with Peter, and I got on the phone with Davey. I couldn't get Mike on the phone right away, but those two guys were kind of interested. They wanted to do something, and I thought, this is really cool. And so I finally got Mike on the phone, and he was really reluctant. He was sort of the most reluctant of the monkeys to even talk to me. And I said, look, we're doing this show. He goes, I don't want to be on this thing, and I don't do the monkey stuff. I'd really rather not. I said, well, okay. And I went back to my boss, Michael Jacobs, who was the head writer of the show. I said, well, I've got three of them. He goes, go get the fourth one. I said, I can't. I can't get him. I said, he won't do it. He said, we'll call the network and see. So I called the network, and I called the Disney executives, and they said, we'll take three of them. That's fine. So it was a wonderful experience because I got to go in the recording studio, and these guys hadn't played together in a long time. It's just beautiful. And, you know, they're recording songs. They didn't want to do monkey songs, but they sang My Girl and something else. And but I'm in the recording studio with these guys. Now, I grew up, I was a huge, I mean, that's the greatest thing about my life is I've been able to meet a lot of my heroes and work with them. And it's just, it's such a wonderful, rewarding experience. So anyway, and we had this wonderful week with them, and I worked them into the story. You can see it. I mean, I think you can even see these things on YouTube. If you look up the monkeys on Boy Meets World, it's got an episode called Rave On. It was like from the fourth or third season. I don't remember. And but it was really fun, and all the staff was like laughing at me. They didn't get the power of the monkeys, but I hang out with Mickey and I see what happens. You know, they draw attention. They're very popular even to this day. So what we didn't realize was not only was it the top rated show that week, we were featured in TV Guide magazine, Entertainment Tonight, all the big shows came down. That we never had that kind of attention on the show. So I was a big hero. But the night of the show, the great thing that happened was Rhino Records, where the monkeys were signed, were giving platinum records to the monkeys. They'd re-release their records and they'd come out in platinum. So Harold Bronson, who was the head of Rhino at the time, asked me if he could do it backstage there, and I said sure. And I'm standing, we're about to shoot the show, and I see this guy, kind of tall lanky guy, kind of slip into the back, and I went, oh my goodness. And I looked it through the window, and it's Mike Nesmith. All four monkeys are sitting there.
I knew you were going to say that.
and I'm like, I'm freaking out. I mean, this to me is, it's like all four Beatles showing up to me, you know? Yeah. And I'm like, Oh my gosh. And so Michael Jacobs comes over. I don't know if you know Michael, but he's like this bigger than life guy. And he comes over and he grabs and goes, get him on the show. I said, he doesn't want to do it. I've already thought. He said, get him on the show. You're a producer. He throws me into the room, right? And so I go into this room. It's a swinging door. And I go into the place, and they all see me, and they're all four talking. They haven't been in the same room in ages. I mean, in almost a decade. And they're there, and I'm watching, and I hear Mike Nesmith talking to Mickey going, well, we should get a recording, a rehearsal space, and see what we got. Maybe we could still do this. I'm going, they're reuniting right here in front of me, and I don't want to say anything. And suddenly Mike slowly turns to me. I know the other guys pretty well at this point. We've been rehearsing all week. And Mike turns to me. I said, I'm kind of nervous. I go, hey, Mike, I'm Jeff Sherman. I talked to you on the phone. He goes, yeah. And I said, you know, since you're here anyway, he goes, I'd really rather not. I said, I know, but because I'm trying my best. I'm not really a great salesman with this stuff, but I'm trying. And Mickey's like shaking his head, don't do this right now. So I said, okay. And I walked out. Michael Jacobs is waiting for him. He goes, did you get him? I said, no. He goes, go back in. And he throws me back into the room. He threw me in the room.
No.
And now they're all staring at me. And Mike, who had been kind of kneeling down, stands up, and he's a tall guy. And it's a little scary. And he turns to me and he goes, I'd really rather not. And I said, gotcha. And I walked back on. Michael said, did you get him? I said, how about if I throw you in there? You try.
Right.
So we didn't get Mike there, but if you watch the show, he was there that night too. So all four monkeys were actually in the room at that point.
Oh my goodness. That's incredible. I love the monkeys too. Huge, huge fan. I remember when they kind of resurged back in the 80s, like, but it was only the three of them. It wasn't Mike, because he'd really rather not, as we know. So
yeah. He went on tour with them this last couple of years. He was doing some dates with them and really enjoyed it. And it was really after Diggy passed away, I think he felt like he wanted to have that experience again, you know?
Yeah.
And they were wonderful. I went to a few of the concerts. They were just terrific. And Mick was great. So, and Nikki and Peter are still going out. I think they just announced some more dates that they're going out now. So
wow.
If anybody wants to go see them, they sound great. Mickey sounds better than he ever sounded.
He came to Epcot Flower and Garden Festival.
Yeah, he's been doing that for years.
Well, he did like one or two after Davey passed away, and then they didn't have him back last year, and I was disappointed because I love hearing him. But it's so good to hear you, a person that was in the room with them when they were singing, because there's all that controversy about them not singing their own songs or whatever in the 60s, so... That's really cool.
Well, you know, what's interesting about it, and they get a lot of flack for that because, you know, everybody knew they were a fabricated band, and they knew it. It's like Mickey always says, it's like thinking that Captain Kirk can really fly a spaceship, you know. But the thing was, they were all musicians. Davey had been in the original cast of Oliver in London. He was one of the, I think he was the Artful Dodger on stage, and came from a long line of that. You know, Mickey had been in bands. Peter was a recording artist, and so was Mike. Mike wrote the song, a different drum for Linda Ronstadt. They were all musicians and quite capable. But what happened was they threw them into the mix. Nikki was a guitarist, and he came in. They said, "You're going to be the drummer." He goes, "I don't play drums." They said, "You will be in 3 weeks." And so he had to learn the drums, and now he's an excellent drummer. And they were playing concerts. And what Mickey always points out is, you know, at the time in that day and age, and it probably still goes on today, but there was a group called the Wrecking Crew. And every band, including Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and everybody had other musicians playing for them. But the Monkees were really singing their vocals, and they really, after a couple of albums, they insisted they wanted to play the instruments. They weren't allowed to. And then they did. And so, you know, even though the inception of the band was they were put together much like NSYNC or the Spice Girls or any of those, you know, sort of fabricated bands, they're no different from that. And they own up to it. They never, you know, but they never did it. But if you see Mickey now play and everything, I mean, he's a terrific musician. He plays guitar and drums and piano. He's great. So and Peter's a really great musician. So
it reminds me of the Partridge Family too. That was all, you know, fake playing.
Right. But again, you know, most singers of the time, most performers of the time, most of those bands had the same studio musicians playing their albums for them. They were, you know, it's just, you know, they would come and play their concerts and stuff, but in the studio, they had studio musicians playing.
Well, and then we fast forward today. I know that you're currently working with Boy Meets World star Will. He's the one that plays Eric Matthews and some other folks too. You're working on a original animated film musical. Is that right?
Yes. I was approached by, maybe your listeners know her. She's a pretty big country star named Shelley Wright. And Shelley got in touch with me. She had written a screenplay, and she asked, she found me on Facebook. I hadn't been a huge follower of country music. I knew the name though, because she'd done that song "Single White Female," and I remember that was a crossover hit, and I'd heard it. But I didn't really put the name with that. And she said she'd written the script, and would I read it and give her notes? And she asked me, first of all, if I was the son of one of the Sherman brothers. I said yes. It was shortly after my father passed away. And so I thought it was just another fan, like, getting in touch with me about my dad. But it turned out to be Shelley, who was this, you know, numerous, I think, 8 or 9 country albums and big star. Anyway, so she said, "Will you read it?" So I read the script, and I said, "I can give you easy notes or hard notes." She goes, "I'm a country girl. Give me the hard notes." So I said, "All right." So I sent them to her. I never expected to hear from her again, because when I write notes even to myself, I don't even talk to myself for a week after I give them to myself. They're so mean. But, you know, they're just vicious notes. And so she calls me up, and she said, "Well, I love your notes. I think you're exactly right. And can you hold on a second? I have a friend who wants to talk to you." I'm thinking, like, oh, this is the guy that's going to beat me up now. And instead, it's Kristen Chenoweth. Who you may know, where she was a Broadway star and TV star. And so Crispin gets on with me, and they're very good friends. And she goes, "I want to get involved in this movie. I read your notes. I think they're brilliant, but I want you to rewrite this with Shelley." And I said, "Well, I'll tell you what. I think it should be a musical, because this story, it's a beautiful story. It's called The Dogs of New York. And beautiful, beautiful story about legacy and honor and wonderful, beautiful things." And So I said, but with her background, she should do it. And Shelley got back on. She said, well, I'll do it as a musical if you write the songs with me. And she didn't know I'd done the Enchanted Musical Playhouse stuff, and I'd written songs for Boy Meets World, et cetera, et cetera. She didn't know that. She just sort of leaped with faith and just said it. And I said, okay, let's see what we can do. Now, Shelley lives in New York, and I'm here in Los Angeles. So we did the whole thing on Skype. We wrote the whole project together just over the screen. Every day it was like meeting, and I didn't know if that was going to work. It was flawless. We had a great time. We wrote songs together. We wrote 9 songs together. And Kristen is attached as our producer and star. And we're in the process right now of trying to set it up. But it's just a wonderful experience for me. And it's something really I've been doing more in my life. When my dad was alive, I always kind of felt a little intimidated about really pursuing the music myself, just because, you know, it's there. And when I was a kid, I got a couple songs published and found that somebody did it as a favor to my dad, and it kind of shot me down. And I thought, I'm just going to wait, you know. And but Shelley's encouraged me, and a bunch of people, Tom Schumacher at Disney Theatrical, and some other people have been encouraging me to really step up and do this, because it's really my main passion in life is writing songs. And so I'm doing that more and more. I'm doing a rock and roll musical right now, feature film, and I'm doing the animated feature with Shelley and Kristen, and a couple of stage things as well. So,
wow.
So that's all coming. That's all in the works right now. So
you are just keeping so busy. That's wow. That's fantastic. Can you kind of mention like how people can? I don't know. I know you're kind of in the early stages with a lot of it, but how can we kind of follow all that and know when things are out so we can check them out?
You could, probably the easiest thing is you can find me on Facebook under my name and Jeff Sherman. And I usually post little things, and I don't always give away what it is, but you'll get a sense of something. We just did a pilot and got a screening of it over here at the house the other couple nights ago. And so I put that up. But I tend to talk about what I'm working on when I can on my Facebook page. So that's probably the best. I don't have like a personal website or anything beyond that, but that's probably the best way to keep in touch with what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's fun. I love being Facebook friends with you. It's the best. So, well, we just want to thank you. Goodness, we just really appreciate your time. This has been so fun. I love hearing your stories, and just you've just had an amazing career. We're so looking forward to everything you've got coming out in the future, and just watching you, and just such a pleasure. Thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the parks.
The Disney Parks Podcast is not affiliated with the Walt Disney Company. All Disney parks, attractions, lands, shows, event names, etc. are registered trademarks of the Walt Disney Company.
Like a boat out of the blue, fate steps in and sees you through one reach upon the stars.